Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
So I'm here today with Gervase Williams, Senior Executive Director at Mighton Group, where he has been on the board for 8 years. He's also a prolific media commentator and has written 3 books, Slow Finance, The Future is Small, and The Retreat of Globalisation. And we're delighted to be speaking with him here today. Gervase, thanks so much for joining us. So can you tell us a little bit about your background, how you even got involved in fund management?
Yes, well, I grew up actually on a farm in South Wales. My parents were farmers. And they had a huge range of different crops. It was only a small farm, but they changed it quite a bit. In a way, they were a bit like fund management farmers. They changed from one thing to another. It wasn't the reason I moved into fund management. I did actually engineering at university. I did some marine and structural engineering thereafter. I became fully chartered. But really, my interest was very much in business, in good business decisions, in good allocation of capital. And I got the opportunity, as soon as I became qualified, to actually join a fund management business in the financial world, a company called Throgmorton Trust. And that was a great opportunity to really learn on the job about the strengths and weaknesses of individual businesses, the advantages of smallness, and most particularly the opportunity to make a good return for investors within a confines of a risk environment.
What did Throgmorton specialise in?
Throgmorton Trust was a trust which involved specifically in small quoted companies. It was one of the leading small quoted company funds at the time, and it had a very long history of doing so. It's still in existence now. And from that point of view, it was a great area to start, and strangely enough, we've remained in that area ever since. Mm.
So who have been the main influences in your career?
I think the overwhelming sort of interest has really been in Ben Graham and his interest in finding companies which have intrinsic value, companies which have low downside risk, hopefully, but most particularly still substantial upside risk. The opportunity of getting involved in companies like that at all stages of the market hopefully is going to generate a premium return, but most particularly within the context of overall risk being relatively limited, not completely limited, but relatively limited. And so that's been a feature which actually has driven quite a large part of our investment style.
And have you had any mentors that have had a big influence?
Well, I mean, the whole team at Throgmorton Trust when I first joined was very dominant. I mean, Bob Seabrook was the eminent investor at the time, Brian Holbrook and others as well. So very much learned from their experience, their record, their knowledge, their past histories, and most particularly some of the stories of some of the things which have gone wrong in the past. So again, very specific individuals, yes.
And did you leave there to go to Mighton, or were there any jumps in between?
No, I left in 1990. It had been there 5 years. It was very good. But that stage had actually changed hands a couple of times, and the momentum in the business seemed to be much less. So I went off and eventually joined Thornton Investment Management, part of Dresdner Bank. I worked there for 3 years. It was very good. We had some small company funds. There was a recession in the UK at the time, so we really had to work extremely hard to generate returns. But fortunately, with Peter Webb, we made a good team. The fund performed very strongly, and that meant that I could therefore was able to join what was County NatWest, which became part of Gartmore ultimately, and that's really where I spent about 18 years of my career.
And so what compelled you to join Mighton?
I think the whole point about investing in the long term is that occasionally it's good to step away from the crowd. And the great advantage of being in a small and relatively agile business is that that gives you more opportunity to actually back your own judgment. And the opportunity for Mighton very much has been to put together portfolios which are genuinely active, portfolios which aren't trying to mimic or at least I'm closely aligned in terms of returns with the underlying market returns, but very much more stock-based investment, bottom-up, very much driving stock selection and leading to returns which aren't just hopefully better than many other funds, but most particularly aren't as correlated. They're not just as tuned in to the movement of stock markets. And that means hopefully, even at times when market returns may be less buoyant, the funds themselves can generate an attractive return.
So over the span of your career, has your investing style changed very much?
I'm sure it's evolved and become more refined, but generally the pattern has remained similar. Very much buying companies with strong intrinsic value, companies with strong balance sheets, companies generally which are well positioned to invest cash. to generate a good cash payback. And it's that cash payback which ultimately gives the ability of the companies either to pay out dividends or to reinvest in further growth thereafter. And it's that's been very much the cornerstone. Of course, there have been periods in the market when things have been topsy-turvy. I remember in 2009 and 2010, when perhaps the best performing stocks by absolute far were those with the most borrowed balance sheets, those which have nearly gone bust, but actually had survived. And so we had to change our process a little bit and be willing to buy companies with much more stretched balance sheets at that stage. So it's not entirely fixed, but most particularly, it's that eye to risk and making sure that we do participate ultimately in long-term return, which is absolutely overwhelmingly important for us.
So at the moment, we've got quite a chaotic macroeconomic picture. And what are the elements of that that investors must understand in order to optimise their portfolios?
Yes, the question of understanding at the moment is quite difficult at the moment. Mm. I think what is interesting is just how many trends have been out there for some considerable period. And normally, over the very long term, you know, since the 1950s or indeed since the 1920s, the best way to make returns is to buy companies which are overlooked, companies with strong price to books, which is a kind of measure of value, mm-hmm. companies which have opportunities to invest and generate returns, so perhaps companies which are moving into sectors which are seeing improved returns. But most particularly, there are periods when growth stocks, those with great stories, growing very fast, companies were able to get plenty of momentum, outperform. And we've been in a period of growth outperformance now for about 5 or 6 years, mm. quite a long period, really most of the period since 2008 when we've had low interest rates. And that's become a very dominant theme. And periods of outperformance from growth stocks certainly have happened in the past, but this has been quite a long period now. And in fact, the overlooked value stocks have actually been in any way slightly overlooked for quite a long period now. And I think when you overlay that with Brexit, of course, has introduced a further anxiety for overseas investors looking at the UK. And so we've seen generally a reluctance by international investors to top up their holdings in the UK. And that's meant that, if anything, the valuation of the UK has slipped versus international stocks, and value stocks have slipped versus normal. And so from that point of view, we've actually had a period of sort of slight dislocation. We're finding superb opportunities at the late stage of a bull market. The bull market's been going for 8 or 10 years now. So from that point of view, to actually find stocks with intrinsic value at this stage of the cycle is most unusual.
And in terms of the macro elements, are you worried about China trade wars? Are you worried about inverted yield curves? Are you worried about any of these sort of macro themes going on?
Yes, I mean, clearly we are worried about any of those themes. I mean, the key interest area from our point of view is the bond yields. Bond yields at ultra low levels implies that overall investment returns in equities and other assets are likely to be subnormal over the coming decade or so. So whilst they might be going fine just at the moment, we shouldn't be assuming there won't be a zig and a zag along the way. So from that point of view, we don't expect the markets themselves to help us a lot. So buying index funds or buying funds which are closely aligned to indices may not produce the returns which we got used to in the past. Therefore, all the more important that we do find opportunities for individual stocks which can buck the economic trend, which can grow when the world's not growing, which can generate an attractive cash payback, which can generate good and growing dividends, irrespective perhaps of the wider challenges of the world. And so from that point of view, we feel pretty excited about the prospects for our funds, albeit that actually they're not enjoying much momentum just now.
Mm-hmm. And do you sell in any conditions when the macro picture goes very wobbly? Is it a time to sell, or how do you handle it?
Yes, I mean, clearly as a fund manager, the very key area we need to really monitor isn't just making the maximum return, of course we're looking to do that, but to actually take risk off the table if we feel uncomfortable with the risk. So that happens all the time. Certain companies have a downturn. We particularly feel uncomfortable if we see companies which have a downturn in turnover, if they come under margin pressure. We don't know how long that'll last. Those are two signals which will cause us to take profits or to actually move out of an existing position. We get a little more uncomfortable usually when companies gear up aggressively. We've seen that occasion in the past. Quite a lot of mainstream companies now have a lot more debt than they used to. So we are wary of strong balance sheets. And of course, valuations. When things perform really strongly, sometimes we have a good story that valuations move to extraordinary levels. And that's great in a way because we've made plenty of money, but we probably are a bit early at selling, but we'd rather sell on the way up than on the way down. So from that point of view, those are our four areas which cause us to sell. Clearly, not all our investments are successful, but hopefully if we get a number of which actually do enter a long period of cash payback and good cash generation, that growing dividend in particular can often drive share prices even in unfavourable markets.
So do you set yourself a target price? It's always very tricky to know when to sell. And people say keep your winners, but it's tricky when they get highly valued. So how do you make that call?
It is. I mean, the main thing is to keep reviewing our existing holdings. So we do see our companies on a very regular basis, just to check and see how things are going. We check them against what we call our traffic light process, whether there's a red light in terms of growth or green light in terms of growth, and all the other metrics I mentioned earlier. So we keep an eye on that. But generally, it's a case of actually we meet a lot of other companies. We meet some new companies coming to market. We meet some companies which are disappointed in the past where they're seeing recovery. We meet certain companies which are, for whatever reason, moving into new markets which have now got much, much more attractive returns. So there's always a tension actually from new aspirants coming into our portfolio compared with many of our existing holdings. That said, it's very interesting. Many of our existing holdings have been in the portfolio since I joined Mitan. So we haven't necessarily changed everything. Sometimes the green lights do remain on for many years, though in general, we don't really have much more visibility than a 12 or an 18-month period. And so, you know, the fact we've got them at 5, 7, 8 years since I joined actually means that actually things have kept going rather than we knew 8 years ago that we'd be holding them for 8 years.
And when you buy in, how long do you, what timeline do you reckon that you're buying in for?
Well, I think you've got to be very wary of making too many assumptions about the future. Clearly, you have to have that in mind, environment in your mind, particularly when you're buying small companies, companies which are less liquid. You can't afford to hold companies which are uncertain at a time perhaps when liquidity gets more difficult. So we do look ahead and we do try to steer around potholes before they arrive. But most of the time, it's only for 12 or 18 months ahead. We don't really think we've got much confidence about predicting the future over the next 5 years. I mean, look at the last 5 years. Mm. You know, how many people would have predicted all the Brexit and the disruptions we've had in the last 5 years?
So today, how has your stock selection changed as against 2 years ago or 5 years ago?
I think generally the patterns remain fairly consistent. Very fortunately, the investment process we follow here has been something which has been proved over time. It's generated good returns in most of the cases for many years in the past. And so although it doesn't outperform every year or it does have periods of underperformance, specifically, actually, the right metrics for us tend to pay out in the end. And so it's slightly dangerous for us to keep evolving. That said, I mean, nearly all investors have become a little bit more pro-growth. Growth has been so much there for the last few years. It's not that we've become more pro-growth, but actually it's been an area which has been attracting a lot of other investors. We've seen some of our companies move into what might be called growth valuations, and we've lucked out large when that's happened. But it's not because we selected them because they were growth stocks. It's just they evolved into growth stocks, and that's meant we've made abnormal returns on those, taken those profits and reinvested back into those with real interest. Value. So no real change other than we've lucked out a couple of times.
And the market dynamics, the market legislation, you know, we've got MiFID II and other legislation that's come in. Does that affect liquidity, particularly when you're dealing a lot in small caps?
I mean, liquidity is a crazily important issue because you need to have liquidity to set the right prices, to set the right prices for companies, not just to buy and sell, but to raise additional capital. And the cost of equity is tremendously important in giving capital to those kinds of companies, the right kind of companies which are going to put that capital to work. So liquidity has generally been quite a difficult area. It's probably become a more difficult area in the last few years when market liquidity has come back. Market makers have less capital than they used to. Many of the investment banks have scaled back their investment books. So from that point of view, generally, small and big companies have had less liquidity going forward. We've always worked very closely to maximise liquidity in our portfolios. We do that by investing across a wider range of companies than many others. That includes big and small companies, but includes across different sectors, different parts of the world. So from that point of view, having that liquidity there so that if we do need liquidity, if we do need to sell, we can sell the bits of a much larger list of holdings rather than a relatively tight list of holdings, means that we do maximise liquidity. But going forward, specifically, liquidity has become a little harder. I don't think it's so much down to MiFID II. I think it's due to the capital on the markets. I think it's due to Brexit effects. I think it's due to reluctance at the moment for people to take risks given the uncertainty going forward. So I think that has been a feature. But going forward, if you invest in companies with strong balance sheets, then of course, at worst, if we do get a big rumpus in the markets and there are share prices which fall to abnormally low levels, then they can buy back their shares. Mm. And that means that actually investors still have an exit, albeit that it's not necessarily an attractive price.
So you don't think funds are moving out of the small cap space because it's just getting too illiquid?
I do think that generally most investors have de-emphasized small and micro caps, but I don't think it's specifically due to liquidity. I think for the last 30 years, the globalization of world trade has been excellent in driving top line growth, not so much just for big companies and small companies, but for companies in the UK and companies around the world. So there's been many more companies to select from. And I think most investors have become much more aligned to actually picking out mid and large cap sized companies, given that they've produced such good returns. I think over the last 30 years, small companies, whilst they've grown well, it's been not a distinctive feature. And they're small and fiddly. And because they have less liquidity, a lot of investors have learned to move beyond them. I think going forward, I think smallness is going to be much more important, not just because small companies can grow when the world's not growing, but most particularly, they can take advantage of the weakness of others. If we do get a downturn in the world economy at some stage, if we do find that companies unfortunately lose out and there's more companies like Carillion which go bust, then there will be opportunities for small quoted companies, agile management teams, to issue new shares, to buy assets from the receiver, and to make abnormally large cash returns on those investments. And that's the opportunity. It's not really been a feature for the last 30 years. We do think globalization is coming to an end. We do think that actually companies are becoming more interested in their own interests rather than sharing with other countries around the world. And we think one of the side effects is, unfortunately, there may be more unsettled economic trends, and most particularly more risk of downside risk with individual companies going bust. So good and small and quoted companies, we believe, will actually be well positioned to outperform as they did in the 70s and the 60s in that period, though of course that hasn't arrived as yet.
So it sounds a bit of a contradiction in that you have been getting a wider spread because liquidity is an issue, but equally you see the opportunities in the small cap space. So have you been upweighting or downweighting small caps, or has it not changed?
Now, the main issue is actually, of course, many of the companies we invest in are quite small. So they might be 50 million market cap, even smaller in certain cases. Now, many people associate very small companies like that with very small businesses. But of course, these are still big businesses. They employ thousands of people. They put millions of pounds of turnover through their accounts. And in many cases, they're just small in that they dominate a small niche rather than being a big company dominating many large niches. And therefore, they can be often one of the large companies in their sector, albeit that they're a small quoted company. So coming back to your point, the point is, if we want to invest in companies with 50 million market cap, or indeed 25 million market cap, we can't always buy 1 or 2% of our portfolio in those companies. They are, by their nature, small, which means that sometimes we have to make do with 0.25%, which means that we get a longer list of companies. But the conviction we have in our positions, the opportunity in terms of cash payback is very much there. And of course, when they do come right, some of these companies, they don't just rise 30 or 50%. Sometimes they rise a multiple of the original investment. And that's the upside opportunity for getting these small companies right. Clearly, you've got to get enough of them right. Clearly, the economic conditions are not irrelevant and some companies go down. But most particularly, the risk-reward ratio can be very, very attractive in this end of the market.
So does it mean you have to have more holdings, and doesn't that come with its own problems?
Yes, we do tend to have more holdings in our portfolios. There are problems, I suppose, in when we get something right, it makes a difference, but it doesn't change the overall outcome of the portfolio. But of course, when we get things wrong, and sadly we do as well, it means that actually the downside risk is more moderated as well. So what tends to happen is actually overall, our funds can produce a very attractive return compared with many others, certainly a competitive return, but most particularly, we can do so with a wider sector representation, with a wider range of individual companies, and with hopefully a combined sort of volatility of the portfolio as being not as adverse as you might expect. In many cases, many of our portfolios tend to be less volatile because they've got this wider sector range compared with perhaps the mainstream indices. And so the risk-reward ratio actually tends to work out in favour of clients in general, albeit that there are periods when, of course, the trends move against us.
And can you keep on top of that many companies? So meet management and really understand the story when you've got a wider and wider portfolio.
Yes, the nature of investment, particularly at the smaller end of the market, is that we are obviously bigger percentages of those companies. So rather than having a 0.5% of a FTSE company, we might have 5 or even 15% of some of the smaller quoted companies. So these are closer relationships. We're a bigger shareholder, probably a bit more influential. And most particularly, we see them very regularly. We see some of their competitors regularly. We see some of their customers regularly. We see some of their suppliers regularly. So from that point of view, we actually see them in all sorts of ways, albeit that they're different companies which we're meeting. So we tend to meet very large numbers of companies. We have a huge number of management teams which come through. It's a very stimulating and enjoyable part of the job. But most particularly, what's really interesting is that gives us a really immediate sort of coalface view of what's going on in the real world. Mm-hmm. And we're not reliant in the way on the third-party conversations from some of the major commentators. We actually have a strong view ourselves. So very particularly, come back to your question, actually having this wide range of companies, having this huge opportunity to meet so many different types of businesses and different parts of the value chain means that actually we like to think that that gives us a really good indication of what's going on under the surface, hopefully to make informed decisions, and most particularly from that point of view, keeping right on top of quite a long list of stocks.
So if you're meeting management all the time, what's the view at the coalface on Brexit?
Generally, it's an uncertainty, it's an anxiety. But in most companies, it isn't going to be a game changer. Mm. They may be domestic businesses, in which case operating in the UK, and to some degree, apart from imports and exports and supplies, generally, they'll just get on with their business. The UK will be what the UK is, and they get on. Many others are multinationals. They have operations in the UK. They have operations around the world. And so if they're struggling to supply from the UK operations, they might use one of their overseas plants or one of their overseas services centres to actually supply. So from that point of view, they also tend to find a way around it. Clearly, the companies which are most vulnerable are probably those which are dependent on imports and exports from the UK, particularly physical products coming in by lorry loads and such like. So from that point of view, you know, there could be some disruption. But even there, we've been there before. We've had a refugee crisis. We've had people queuing up the various motorways at Calais and such like. So again, it's not new stuff. It's just features we've been through. We tend to worry about many more international issues in a much bigger way. You know, the slowdown in world growth, perhaps anxiety in the Middle East, perhaps a problem, perhaps in a big setback in interest rate rises or whatever else might happen. So those are the things we really worry about. Brexit, whilst it's clearly important for the UK, is actually to some degree an issue which we believe is less significant compared with the bigger issues in other areas.
Interesting. So looking forward, both in the short term to the end of the year and the next 18 months, what's your prognosis for the stock market?
Well, the stock market's had a terrific run, actually, particularly this last 4 months. It's moved up very substantially. Clearly, it was much more unsettled last year. We saw a very a significant slowdown in world growth. Various share prices turned out to be quite weak. So we're sort of in a period of zig and zag, as far as I'm concerned. So it could well be that perhaps markets continue to rally. UK quoted companies appear a little overlooked versus international companies because of Brexit. Smaller quoted companies, particularly those with a value bias, look particularly overlooked in the context of the UK and most particularly in the context of international companies. So there's plenty of upside. I think there could be more bid activity after Brexit. Mm. On the other hand, clearly we've taken an awful lot of debt on over recent years. We're becoming more me first in terms of politics around the world, not just in the US, but in Europe as well, and indeed in Asia. So from that point of view, all of that's leading to perhaps a little bit more uncertainty, a little bit more friction, a little bit more downside risk. So I think we are anxious about the future, but we still feel very excited by the opportunities by individual companies might have to actually continue to generate a good return. So overall, markets, we are expecting unexciting returns over the long term, but we think that we've got opportunities to generate hopefully a premium return in spite of that going forward.
Are you convinced that we're heading for a global recession, say, at the end of next year, as the yield curve would suggest?
I don't know if I'm convinced, but I'm anxious about it. Mm. We haven't had a global recession for over 10 years now. And from that point of view, we're probably overdue one. This cycle has been the longest probably on record. So from that point of view, that suggests that we're bound to have one day. It's a matter of certainty we will have another recession. And there are ingredients in there in terms of the maturity of the market cycle, the excitement about some of these moonshot stocks coming to market in the US. Mm-hmm. There does seem to be quite a few aspects which look at the sort of end of a bull market ahead of a recession. But we don't know. Mm. And we won't be certain about that. So we've just got to be prudent about it and make sure we continue to invest in companies which can make a return even without a recession. And if we do get a recession, hopefully the portfolios not just are more resilient, but actually can continue to prosper, albeit that their share prices might go down. And as they take advantage of the setbacks in other companies and actually improve their market positions through the cycle.
And what did you make of the stock market dip at the end of last year? What meaning did you give to that?
Well, it's very interesting. I think it was actually, there was quite a pullback in market liquidity. Quite a few markets have generally been very buoyant over recent years, in part because quantitative easing boosts market liquidity. And the pullback of European quantitative easing at the end of last year was a feature which actually sort of reduced market liquidity. And we also saw at the same time the introduction of quantitative tightening, the opposite of quantitative easing in the US, which also reduced market liquidity. And those combination of both those factors, we believe, was actually one of the factors which actually led to more a sort of setback in markets. And along with that, of course, China, which is dependent on international market liquidity, has struggled a bit to get access to the funding it required to continue its growth. And the combination of the Chinese slowdown together with the market liquidity tightness was what we felt actually drove that market wobble at that stage. We think, of course, that could happen again. You know, it may be that quantitative tightening does persist for later this year in the US. It may be that quantitative easing is introduced again, perhaps, but not that much in certain other parts of the world. But it could be that you know, these problems with market liquidity and Chinese growth come to the surface again. So we don't think that's a one-off. We think that those are the kind of periods we're going to have to be steering our clients through, and we just need to be resilient, well-founded. It doesn't mean our share prices won't go down, but it does mean hopefully we can select companies which are safe enough to see this, the storm through, and most particularly, as I say, can take advantage of some of the weakness of others to actually improve their market positions through the weakness of others so that they come out of the other side of any setback stronger, more resilient, more profitable business to generate more cash and more dividends for shareholders.
But quantitative tightening is almost inevitable, isn't it, at some stage?
Well, the problem with quantitative easing, in my view, is that it does distort market prices. And in distorting market prices, it means that companies are often incentivized more to pay out cash now. We've seen a huge volume of buybacks in the US. We've seen a lot of extra dividends paid by shareholders, shares in the UK, at the expense of dividend cover. Safety of that dividend is more questionable going forward. And that has meant probably that actually we haven't been investing as much in long-term capital expenditure to generate extra productivity improvement. Productivity has stagnated over the last 10 years, not so much just in the UK, but around the world. And that is now leading to companies really struggling to find the cash flow growth which they got used to in the past. And as we see, wage growth has been much more muted over recent years, although it's picking up a little bit now. So from that point of view, we've got to be really anxious that, you know, if people don't get a pay rise, they are more inclined to vote for different politics, different economic policies. That's where we are, in a period of economic policy change, probably more economic policy change over this three-year period than we've had for the last 30. So this is a period when fund managers, active fund managers in particular, need to be really attentive in terms of sure-footed about what they're doing on behalf of clients, and actually very risk-aware. We don't want to be taking unnecessary risks, because we could get badly caught out. So from that point of view, all of that suggests that actually this is a part of that zig and zag I talked about, and that, you know, whilst markets may well continue to be good later this year, we shouldn't bet on it, we shouldn't rely on it. We've got to be very wary that actually markets might zig and zag as they did last year.
And what's the maximum cash position you can have as a directive of the funds?
So generally the funds are limited to a maximum 10% cash. Many of the funds have an income bias, so if you held 10% cash, that would mean you generated 10% less income over the year. So that's not a great place to go. So it's quite a tension really as to whether you do hold cash or not. One of the ways we've got around that is to buy put options. Put options are kind of market insurance. If the market gets really wobbly, not slightly wobbly, but really wobbly, then those put options start to go up in value as the market gets weaker. And that means that if markets do suffer a bit of a setback, then those value of those put options would then rise to 4, 8, maybe even 10-12% of the portfolio. And at that stage, we can cash those in, buy more income shares, and generate more income growth, and generate in more upside when the market recovers. So from that point of view, it's a way of managing the risk reward ratio, albeit that the decay value, a bit like your car insurance, it doesn't, you don't get your car insurance back afterwards if you haven't had a car accident. So it does cost around 1% a year for the multi-cap income, for the diverse income trust. So that does, you know, that's been a slight a sort of headwind for the return of the fund. But most particularly, we put it in there specifically because we are unsettled. We're not sure whether last year was a one-off or whether it could come back again. And if markets do get more unsettled, then it's at least we can do something positive about it.
Brilliant. Thank you very much indeed for your time. It's been most interesting.
Thank you very much indeed for the opportunity.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.